11. As Hamilton stood, staring fixedly at the woman, Marcia came quietly over beside him and grated in his ear,
"Be careful, Jack, be careful."
He turned to his wife. "You are in on it?"
"I suppose so."
She shrugged.
"Edith asked me where you were, and I told her. Not the details, just the general outline."
"What category did Silky fall into?" Marcia smiled.
"Edith put it very well. Little snit of a girl, I think she called her."
"There must be quite a lot of them," Hamilton said. "Is it worth it?" Behind Edith Pritchett came Bill Laws and Charlie McFaith. Both were loaded down with armfuls of groceries.
"Big celebration,"
Laws revealed, with a cautious, half-apologetic nod at Hamilton.
"Where's the kitchen? I want to put this stuff down."
"How's it going, friend?"
McFaith said, craftily, with a broad wink.
"Having a good time? I've got 20 cans of beer in this sack. We're all set."
"Great,"
Hamilton said, still dazed.
"All you have to do is snap your fingers,"
McFaith added, his broad face flushed and perspiring.
"I mean, all she has to do."
After McFaith came the small, humorless figure of Joan Rice. The boy, David Pritchett, walked beside her. Taking up the rear hobbled the sour, dignified war veteran, his wrinkled face an expressionless mask.
"Everybody?"
Hamilton inquired, sick with dismay.
"We're going to play charades,"
Edith Pritchett informed him joyously.
"I dropped over this afternoon,"
she explained to Hamilton.
"Your cute little wife and I had a good long heart-to-heart chat."
"Mrs. Pritchett," Hamilton began, but Marcia quickly cut him off.
"Come on in the kitchen and help me get things ready,"
she said to him in a clear, commanding voice. Reluctantly, he followed after her. In the kitchen, McFaith and Bill Laws stood around, awkward and clumsy, not certain how to occupy themselves. Laws grinned fleetingly, a brief grimace touched with apprehension and what might have been guilt. Hamilton couldn't tell. Laws turned hastily away and busied himself unwrapping endless cold cuts and sandwich spreads.
Mrs. Pritchett liked hors d'oeuvres.
"Bridge,"
Mrs. Pritchett was saying emphatically in the other room.
"But we'll need at least 4 people. Can we count on you, Miss Rice?"
"I'm afraid I'm not much good at bridge,"
Miss Rice's colorless voice answered.
"But I'll do the best I can."
"Laws," Hamilton said, "you're too smart for this. I can see McFaith, but not you." Laws didn't look directly at him.
"You worry about yourself," he said huskily. "I'll worry about me."
"Don't you have enough sense to..."
"Massa Hamilton,"
Laws burlesqued,
"I just strings along with what I finds. If an I do, I lives longer."
"Cut it out," Hamilton said, flushing resentfully. "Don't turn that junk on me." Dark eyes mocking, hostile, Laws turned his back. But he was shaking. His hands trembled so badly that Marcia had to take the pound of smoked bacon from him.
"Leave him alone,"
she chastised her husband.
"It's his life."
"That's where you're wrong," Hamilton said. "It's her life. Can you live on cold cuts and sandwich spreads?"
"It's not so bad,"
McFaith said philosophically.
"Wake up, friend. This is the old lady's world, correct? She runs this place. She's the boss."
Arthur Sylvester appeared in the doorway.
"Could I have a glass of warm water and bicarbonate of soda, please? My stomach's a bit acid today."
Putting his hand on Sylvester's frail shoulder, Hamilton said to him,
"Arthur, your god doesn't hang around this place. You won't like it here."
Without a word, Sylvester brushed past him and over to the sink. There he received his glass of warm water and soda from Marcia. Going off in a corner, he concentrated on it, excluding all else.
"I still can't believe it,"
Hamilton said to his wife.
"Believe what, darling?"
"Silky. She's gone. Absolutely. Like a moth you slap between your hands." Marcia shrugged indifferently.
"Well, she's around somewhere in some other world. Back in the real world, she's still catching drinks and strutting her stuff."
The way she said the word real made it sound smutty and contaminated.
"Can I help?"
Edith Pritchett, fluttering coyly, appeared in the doorway, a great mass of wobbling flesh encased in an outrageously garish flowered silk dress.
"Goodness, where can I find an apron?"
"Over in the closet, Edith,"
Marcia said, showing her where. With instinctive aversion, Hamilton drew away from the creature as she waddled past him. Mrs. Pritchett smiled fatuously at him, a knowing expression on her face.
Now, don't you sulk, Mr. Hamilton. Don't spoil our party.
Mrs. Pritchett had waddled back out of the kitchen and into the living room. Hamilton cornered Laws.
You're going to let that monster control your life?
Laws shrugged.
I never had a life. You call guiding people around the Bevatron a life? People who don't understand anything about it. People who wandered in off the streets. A bunch of tourists without technical training.
What are you doing now? A shudder of defiant pride passed over Laws.
I'm in charge of research for the Lachman Soap Company down in San Jose.
I never heard of it.
Mrs. Pritchett invented it.
Not quite looking at Hamilton, he explained.
It makes those fancy perfumed bath soap.
Christ, Hamilton said.
That isn't much, is it? Not for you. You wouldn't be caught dead with a job like that.
I wouldn't manufacture perfumed soaps for Edith Pritchett, no.
I tell you what,
Laws said in a low, unsteady voice.
You try being colored a while. You try bowing and saying yes, sir, to any piece of white trash that happens to come along. Some Georgia cracker so ignorant he blows his nose on the floor. So moronic he can't find the men's room without somebody to guide him there. Me to guide him there. I practically have to show him how to let down his pants. Try that a while. Try putting yourself through 6 years of college washing white men's dishes in a two-bit hash house. I've heard about you. Your dad was a big-shot physicist. You had plenty of money. You weren't working in any hash house. Try getting a degree the way I did. Try carrying that degree around in your pocket a few months looking for a job. Winding up guiding people around with an armband on your sleeve, like one of those Jews in a concentration camp. Then maybe you won't mind operating the research end of a perfumed soap plant.
Even if the soap plant doesn't exist?
It exists here.
Laws's dark, lean face was bleak with defiance.
And that's where I am. As long as I'm here, I'm going to make the best of it.
But, Hamilton protested, this is an illusion.
Illusion?
Laws grinned sarcastically. With his hard fist, he thumped the wall of the kitchen.
It feels real enough to me.
It's in Edith Pritchett's mind. A man of your intelligence.
Say that.
Laws broke in brutally.
I don't want to hear it. Back there, you weren't so concerned with my intelligence. You didn't particularly mind if I was a guide. You didn't act very bothered.
Thousands of people are guides, Hamilton said uncomfortably.
People like me, maybe. But not people like you. Want to know why I'm better off here? Because of you, Hamilton. It's your fault, not mine. Think that over. You've made some attempt back there. But you didn't. You had your wife and house and cat and car and job. You had it fine. Naturally, you want to go back. But not me. I didn't have it so fine. And I'm not going back.
You are if this world ceases, Hamilton said. A cold, vitriolic hate appeared on Laws' face.
You break this up?
That's your life.
You want me back with an armband, don't you? You're like the others. You're no different. Never trust a white man, that's what they told me. But I thought you were my friend.
Laws, Hamilton said, you're the most neurotic son of a bitch I've ever met.
If I am, it's your fault.
I'm sorry you feel that way.
It's the truth,
Laws said emphatically. Not exactly. Part of it is true. There's a hard kernel of truth down in it somewhere. Maybe you're right. Maybe you ought to stay here. Maybe this would be the better place for you. Mrs. Pritchett will take care of you if you get down on all fours and make the right noises. If you walk the proper distance behind her and don't annoy her. If you don't mind perfumed soap and cold cuts and asthma cures. Back in the real world, you'd have to keep fighting it out with everybody. Maybe it's time you had a rest. You probably couldn't have won anyhow.
Stop pestering him,
McFaith said, listening.
It's a waste of time. He's nothing but a coon.
You're wrong, Hamilton said to McFaith. He's a human being, and he's tired of losing. But he won't win here, and neither will you. Nobody wins here but Edith Pritchett.
Laws, he said, this will be worse than being pushed around by white men. In this world, you'll be in the hands of a fat, middle-aged white woman.
Dinner's ready,
Marcia called sharply from the living room.
Everybody come and get it.
One by one, they filed into the living room. Hamilton emerged, just in time to see Ninny Numcat, attracted by the smell of food, appear in the doorway. Rumpled from having slept in a shoebox in the closet, Ninny wandered across Edith Pritchett's line of march. Crossly, half-stumbling, Mrs. Pritchett said,
"Goodness!"
And Ninny Numcat, getting ready to hop up on somebody's lap, disappeared. Mrs. Pritchett went on her way without noticing.
a tray of petit fours gripped by her lumpy pink fingers.
"She took your cat,"
David Pritchett spoke up shrilly, in a loud, accusing voice. "Don't worry about it," Marcia said absently. "There are plenty more."
"No," Hamilton corrected thickly. "There aren't. Remember? There goes the whole class of cats."
"What was that?"
Mrs. Pritchett asked.
"What was that term? I didn't catch it."
"Never mind," Marcia said quickly, seating herself at the table and beginning to serve. The others took their places. The last to appear was Arthur Sylvester. Having finished his glass of warm water and baking soda, he entered from the kitchen, carrying a pitcher of tea.
"Where'll I put this?"
he asked querulously, hunting for a place on the crowded table, the glass pitcher large, slippery and shiny in his withered hand.
"I'll take it,"
Mrs. Pritchett said, smiling vacantly. As Sylvester came toward her, she reached up for the pitcher. Sylvester, without a change of expression, raised the pitcher and brought it down on the woman's head with all his atrophied strength. A gasp of disbelief rose from the table. Everybody was on his feet. An instant before the pitcher struck, Arthur Sylvester faded out of existence. The pitcher itself, falling from his dissolved hands, dropped to the carpet, shattered and rolling. Tea spilled everywhere, an ugly urine-colored stain.
"Oh, dear,"
Mrs. Pritchett said, vexed. Along with Arthur Sylvester, the smashed pitcher, the pool of steaming tea, ceased to exist.
"How unpleasant,"
Marcia managed after a while.
"I'm glad that's over,"
Law said thinly, his hand shaking.
"That was close."
Abruptly, Joan Rice rose from the table.
"I'm not feeling well. I'll be back in a moment."
Turning quickly, she hurried out of the living room, down the hall, and disappeared into the bedroom.
"What's wrong?"
Mrs. Pritchett inquired anxiously, gazing around the table.
"Is there something upsetting the girl? Perhaps I can..."
"Miss Rice,"
Marcia called in an urgent, penetrating voice.
"Please come back here. We're eating dinner."
"I'll have to go see what's troubling her,"
Mrs. Pritchett sighed, beginning to struggle to her feet. Hamilton was already out of the room.
"I'll handle it,"
he said over his shoulder. In the bedroom, Miss Rice sat, her hands folded in her lap, her coat, hat, and purse beside her.
"I told him not to,"
she said quietly to Hamilton. She had taken off her horn-rimmed glasses. They rested loosely between her fingers. Her eyes, exposed, were pale and weak, almost colorless.
"That's not the way to do it."
"Then it was planned?"
"Of course. Arthur, the boy, and myself. We met today. That's all we can count on. We were afraid to approach you, because of your wife."
"You can count on me,"
Hamilton said. From her purse, Miss Rice took a small bottle and laid it on the bed beside her.
"I'm going to put her to sleep,"
she said tonelessly.
"She's old and worn out."
Sweeping up the bottle, Hamilton held it to the light. It was a liquid preparation of chloroform used in biological specimen fixing.
"But this'll kill her."
"No, it won't."
David, the boy, appeared anxiously in the doorway.
"You better come back. Mother's getting fretful."
Rising to her feet, Miss Rice took back the bottle and stuffed it in her purse.
"I'm all right now. It was the sudden shock. He had promised not to do it, but these old soldiers..."
"I'll do the job," Hamilton told her.
"Why?"
"I don't want you to kill her, and I know you will."
For a moment they faced each other. Then, with a brief impatient twitch, Miss Rice fished out the bottle and pushed it in his hands.
"Do a good job, then, and do it tonight."
"No, sometime tomorrow. I'll get her outdoors, on a picnic. We'll take her up into the mountains early in the day, as soon as it's light."
"Don't get frightened and back out."
"I won't,"
he said, pocketing the bottle. He meant it.